Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Mary Swift here on behalf of Mr. Cowan. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, a new trial is necessary in Mr. Cowan's case for several reasons. The unduly suggestive photo montage, the improper weapon evidence, as well as the prosecutor's burden shifting in rebuttal. I'm happy to answer any of this court's questions related to those substantive issues, but I think really the open questions of law relate to sentencing issues, and so I plan to focus my time on comparability and same criminal conduct. Going first to comparability, the state has conceded that none of the 11 North Carolina convictions are legally comparable. It has further conceded that it failed to prove 7 of the convictions are factually comparable. And so that leaves us with 4 disputed convictions at this point, 3 breaking and enterings and 1 felony larceny. And really what that comes down to is, what did Mr. Cowan admit to when he pled guilty to those crimes? And our position is that question is answered by the U.S. Supreme Court in DeCamp, which says that a person, when he pleads guilty only to the elements of the offense, the statutory elements of the offense. And DeCamp said it wasn't really an exception, but a sentencing court can look outside of the elements of the offense, basically when you have an alternative means crime. And you can look to a charging document, a plea colloquy or whatnot, jury instructions, to determine essentially what crime, what alternative mean the defendant was convicted of. And so that might be relevant here with the felony larceny, which is an alternative means crime under North Carolina law. And Mr. Cowan was convicted of felony larceny under the means that he committed it pursuant to a break and entering. And so that's a perfect example then of where the charging document has superfluous facts outside of the elements of the crime. It includes a dollar amount, which under that alternative in North Carolina law is irrelevant. It says specifically under that alternative that it's without regard to the value of the property. And what the DeCamp court recognized, and actually what the Washington Supreme Court recognized in Lavery in 2005, is a defendant is going to have little incentive to contest superfluous facts when he pleads guilty or even if he goes to a jury trial. All that matters are the elements of the offense. And so that's where you really run up against that Sixth Amendment problem identified in DeCamp, is that then you have a sentencing court later determining facts outside of the elements of the crime, which violates the law as stated in the U.S. Supreme Court case of Apprendi decided in 2000.
What if we had a signed defendant's statement of plea on guilty that specifically recited the dollar amount?
I think that is still within the limitation of DeCamp in that that would be outside the elements of the offense.
But the judge isn't really doing fact-finding there. There's actually a express admission. Isn't that different?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And that's because of that same reasoning that the defendant would have little incentive to contest that dollar amount because it's not an element of the offense.
Well, a defendant normally wouldn't sign something under oath that wasn't true, would he?
Well, One would hope not, but I don't think that that's the reality. And what the DeCamp court recognized is that often a defendant will reach an agreement with the prosecution to plead down to an offense that maybe isn't exactly how that crime occurred, but they've reached an agreement that he will plead guilty to the lesser offense. And so basically you have the defendant not disputing the facts as alleged by the prosecution because he wants to get the benefit of that bargain. And that.
So you would draw no distinction between not disputing something and stating under oath that something is true?
I would draw no distinction there, Your Honor, based on the language in DeCamp. And really, I think the Supreme Court in Washington Supreme Court in Lavery really exercised a lot of foresight in stating, they stated explicitly in that case, where the statutory elements of the foreign crime are broader, the foreign conviction truly cannot be said to be comparable. And that's where you can look to these documents only in determining which means the defendant was convicted of. And so with regard to the breaking and entering here, the North Carolina statute says any felony or larceny therein. Well, those aren't alternative means. Just like in Washington, a burglary is with intent to commit a crime against persons or property therein, which is not alternative means because those aren't distinct acts. And so really what we have, just like in DeCamp, is an indivisible statute with this breaking and entering. And so we don't need to look outside to those outside documents. All that Mr. Cowan pled guilty to was the elements of the offense, because he'd have little incentive to dispute anything beyond the elements of the offense.
Before you run out of time, I did have one question on the knife.
Sure.
I'm having trouble getting to your 404B analysis. How is the knife evidence of crimes, wrongs, or acts?
Well, that's where the I know I can't remember whether it's the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals, but the Foxhoven Court recognized that 404B evidence is any evidence that says this person acted consistently at the time of the crime.
Well, but he's got a knife, and there's testimony that the knife was not a crime itself, just possession of the knife.
Right.
I mean, isn't that just pure propensity evidence?
Well, that's why I've analyzed it under 404B, is that it is, at this point, pure propensity evidence that he's a knife-carrying type person, and 404B encompasses any act that says this person acted in conformity with the crime.
Why isn't that circumstantial evidence? And you complain that there's no forensic evidence connecting the knife to the crime. There's no forensic evidence excluding it either, is there?
There's not, but we...
Well, let me give you... Guy's seen robbing a bank with a shotgun, sawed-off shotgun, and it's a Browning. 2 days later, he's stopped, and he's got a sawed-off Browning shotgun in his car. Isn't that some circumstantial evidence you got the same guy?
Well, that is within the Luveen decision, where there were factors connecting the weapons. And here we have the state...
Well, I don't have any factors connecting the weapon in my case. It just happens to be the same make and a distinctive weapon. And in your case, we have a 4-inch folding knife, which is not commonly carried around by people.
Well, I think I would disagree with that it's not necessarily carried around commonly by people. As the state has acknowledged in its response brief, you know, it's not all that unusual to carry a knife. So at this point, it's basically just Mr. Cowan is a knife-carrying type person, and therefore that makes it more likely that he committed this crime. And we have the state acknowledging that this probably wasn't the knife used in the stabbing.
Thank you.
May I plead the court? I'm Seth Fine, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for Snohomish County, representing the respondent of the state of Washington. I'd like to start with the issue that Your Honors were just asking about with regard to the knife. Counsel is correct that the rule against propensity evidence is not limited to such evidence as is wrongful or as covers a crime or wrongful act. So I would agree that if this knife had been offered for the purpose of proving propensity, it should have been excluded under ER 404B. The problem with their argument is that's not the purpose it was offered for, and it was not the purpose it was used for. It was used as proof of identity, and there is no rule that every item that's used for proof of identity has to meet the balancing test under ER 404B or be so distinctive as to be like a signature. Just as the fact that the defendant was seen prior to the crime wearing a coat similar to that worn by the perpetrator, that's evidence of identity. The state didn't have to show that that coat was so unique as to be like a signature, and it wasn't barred by 404B. In the same way, his possession of a similar knife doesn't implicate 404B and is admissible as proof of identity. Now, in reviewing this, court should bear in mind introduction of evidence generally is a matter within the discretion of the trial court. This was ruled on at pretrial. certain facts were represented to the court and it ruled on that basis, that's the evidence we ought to be looking at to see whether the court abused its discretion. As it turned out, not the evidence introduced at trial didn't match the prosecutor's office it offer. It put certain questions necessary to bring it within that weren't asked, whether that was because the witnesses had changed their story or through inadvertence, we don't know. But the objection was never renewed. There was no renewed opportunity for the court to exercise its discretion.
Well, what could the court have done? That was in rebuttal argument, right? So the court would have had to declare a mistrial?
And if the argument is that the prosecutor's suggestion or admission and argument that it wasn't the same knife, you know, thereby retroactively rendered the knife inadmissible, well, yes, the court had a number of options. It could have struck the evidence of the knife and instructed the jury to disregard it or declared a mistrial. That would depend on the court's assessment of how prejudicial it was. And frankly, in this case, the prejudicial impact of the possession of the knife is pretty minimal. This is not a criminal knife. It's a knife that ordinary, honest citizens may lawfully possess, which, well, we won't speculate on why no objection was raised, but the alternative of telling the jury to disregard it is an entirely realistic one, and up to the court to assess the impact of it. So having dealt with that, I'd like to talk about the sentencing issue, and in particular the comparability issue. And again, counsel is correct that at this point we are focusing on four specific North Carolina convictions. And we've got three charges of breaking and entering where the charging document alleged intent to commit larceny, and we have a charge of larceny where the charging document alleged a particular value of the property, $2,800. Is that enough to make them comparable? Now, the first thing to observe, the main reliance it's put here is on the U.S. Supreme Court DeCompe case. DeCompe is not a Blakely case, but DeCompe is a case under the Armed Career Criminal Act. It's ultimately an issue of statutory interpretation. What did Congress mean in that statute when it referred to convicted of certain generic crimes? And the Supreme Court has said in the past that you look solely to the elements of those crimes in determining whether a person was convicted of those. In other words, the test under the Armed Career Criminal Act is purely one of legal comparability. There is no factual comparability prong. There is what the U.S. Supreme Court calls a modified categorical approach, where when a crime can be committed in multiple ways, you try to identify the particular way in which it was charged, and if that means of commission is comparable, that's good enough. That, again, is not the same as the factual comparability that we do in Blakely. That DeCompe is largely unhelpful here. The proposition we're arguing for is that the effect of a guilty plea is determined by the law of the state, and the reasons for that are pretty evident. You have no constitutional right to a guilty plea. Factual comparability under Blakely doesn't have to rest on a guilty plea. It can rest on stipulation. Each state should be able to decide for itself when you come in, when you plead guilty, these are the facts that you're going to have to admit. Admit those or don't plead guilty, go to trial. It's a matter of state procedure. In North Carolina, under the cases that I've cited, the rule is that you plead guilty to the allegations in the indictment, and by your plea, you admit each and every one of those, and if you don't want to, well, under certain circumstances, you can lodge a contemporaneous objection and say, I'm pleading guilty, but I'm not admitting these. Otherwise, you've admitted it. On the other cases, you're stuck. But even if you go beyond that, even if this is an element-based analysis, what are elements? Elements are what the state would have to prove to obtain a conviction at trial. In a jury trial, of course, it's pretty easy. The elements are what the jury found. In a guilty plea, the test should be basically the same. The elements are what the jury would have to find under that charging document. And again, in North Carolina, the law is clear. If the prosecutor chooses to charge breaking and entering with intent to commit larceny, they must prove breaking and entering with intent to commit larceny, not some other felony. If the defendant had gone
Does
to trial...
Does North Carolina have a rule similar to Washington where if the prosecutor adds into the indictment what we call an added element, that the state then must prove it beyond a reasonable doubt?
I can't tell you if that exists in general, but it does exist in the specific instance of breaking and entering. And there is a case cited in my brief where the prosecution charged breaking and entering with intent to commit attempted murder and could not then prove at trial that the defendant attempted to commit assault when the prosecutor attempted to amend the indictment to change that allegation. The court said, no, that's a material amendment. You, prosecutor, can't do that. You have to go back to the grand jury to change it. So here, you know, you don't have to, in North Carolina, you don't have to allege what the underlying felony is, but if you do, you have to prove it. In this case, the defendant had every incentive to deny that he broke and entered with intent to commit larceny, because if he had, in fact, broken and entered with intent to commit possession of a controlled substance, let's say, he could not be convicted under these charging documents. Now, with regard to the larceny, the issue is a little more subtle, but it is still effectively an element of the offense, bearing in mind that under Blakely, elements and sentencing factors are identical. For that purpose, in that context, there is no difference. And again, North Carolina law is clear. You know, the amount of money stolen can be an aggravating factor, allowing a sentence in excess of their guidelines range. And if a person pleads guilty to an information alleging that they stole a particular amount of money, that aggravating factor is established and can be imposed by the court without further findings. So this amount, $2,800, is not technically an element of the crime, but it is an element of a sentencing factor.
Is the North Carolina case law holding, as you've described, post-Blakely case law?
With regard to the aggravating factor, those are pre-Blakely cases as far
They're
as...
pre-Blakely
yeah,
cases.
That's,
so we
that's
don't
correct.
Know what North Carolina would say post-Blakely with respect to that.
I can only say that I'm not aware that they have reconsidered those cases post-Blakely, nor have they reaffirmed them post-Blakely. At this point, and particularly with regard to these pleas, or this particular plea was to an offense committed back in 2004. Well, there is no reason to think that the plea meant anything other than what North Carolina law said. So we agree that the case needs to be remanded for resentencing without further evidence. Seven of these prior convictions will not count. The other four on this existing record should properly be counted.
Just wanted to briefly address the applicability of DeCamp to Washington. The U.S. Supreme Court did analyze the ACCA and it's conducted statutory interpretation of that, but it also conducted an explicit Sixth Amendment analysis, which then was considered by the Washington Supreme Court in Olson in 2014. And there, the court said we are limited by the DeCamp's recognition that recognition of the Sixth Amendment problems that admitting facts outside the elements of the offense presents. And so the Olson court basically applied DeCamp. And in that case, there was a California conviction for terrorist threats, which has two alternative means, a threat to cause great bodily harm and a threat to kill. And then they looked only to the external documents, the charging documents, to determine which of those means Mr. Olson pled guilty to. And that's the law under Olson, that's the law under DeCamp. And so that's what this court has to do. As I've discussed, committing a felony or larceny therein is not an alternative means. It's they're not distinct acts, and so this court cannot look outside of that, the elements of the offense, in determining whether those crimes are factually comparable. I just briefly wanted to touch on, in the opening brief, I stated that the warrant for arrest and indictments for those crimes said a larceny therein. It's only the warrants for arrest that say a larceny therein for the other seven convictions. The indictment just says a felony therein, and I think the state would agree that we can't rely on a warrant for arrest to prove underlying facts, whether it's the North Carolina law or DeCamp that applies. And finally, Apprendi was decided in 2000, and Blakely, I believe, in 2005 or 2006. And so this has been the law for a long time. The North Carolina case that the state is primarily relying on was decided in 1985, well before these laws decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, which also occurred before Mr. Cowan's convictions in these cases. So we would ask this court to reverse Mr. Cowan's convictions and remand for new trial, or alternatively remand for resentencing, and conclude that none of these crimes are factually comparable. Thank you.
Thank you.